Hello and welcome to Celebrating Cinema.
Yay!
A podcast for the love of cinema. As always, I'm joined by Hugo.
Hey, what's up?
Tom.
What up?
And this time, Basher Moore.
Hi.
And Basher is back for Tom's special episode of Guilty Pleasures. Perhaps, Tom, you can tell us why you've picked this and a definition of what Guilty Pleasures are.
So, we're screening The Room. Tommy Wiseau's The Room. The So Bad It's Good movie. The day afterwards, we have our two sold-out screenings following the screening, which was very conveniently booked on my birthday that you were at, Elliot. It was your maiden voyage seeing it, right? Together with all spoons flying around and stuff like that, amongst other things. And seeing it again and realizing how wonderful it is, I thought maybe we should think and talk about what is a guilty pleasure. So I looked up the definition of a guilty pleasure, and from that we can maybe start a conversation of what that means for us, looking at films that we hold in high regard, but somehow some elite doesn't think we should be watching, but we still like. So here's the guilty pleasure Wikipedia page. A guilty pleasure is something such as a film, a television program, or a piece of music that one enjoys despite understanding that it is not generally held in high regard or is seen as unusual or weird. For example, a person may secretly like a movie but will admit that that particular movie is poorly made and or generally seen as not good.
Total shit.
As I said earlier, like, I have no idea what this really means. And it brought back a memory of my ex-girlfriend once telling me that I should stop calling things guilty pleasures, because she always said, like, things that like that don't exist at all. You either like something or you don't. There's no need to feel guilty about really enjoying the Naked Gun franchise or enjoying the comedy movies that Schwarzenegger made in the 90s. There's nothing wrong with liking Twins.
In a secret lab, somewhere in the Western Hemisphere, the perfect human specimen has been born. He has the strength of 10 men and the wisdom of 20. He also has a twin brother.
I have a brother?
Oh my goodness, are you looking good?
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Born to be bad.
And Danny DeVito.
Way to go, Mom.
Are twins.
My name is Julius. I'm your twin brother.
Obviously.
That's right.
Twins. Coming this Christmas.
I do think it serves a purpose to feel shame or to feel guilty about something, about liking something. And I've been thinking about this. What is this purpose for me? And it is that some things I don't like. There are things like, for example, Naked Gun. I like the Naked Gun. I will talk about it at parties. I don't care. I'm not really ashamed.
Nice beaver.
Thank you. I just had it stuffed.
Let me help you with that.
But there are things that I don't like telling people about because it's really private. So when I'm watching those movies, it's actual me time. So it's something that's not for that's not a kind of performance. Like, this is my taste for everyone to see. It's something that I enjoy by myself. And it is because it's bad, actually.
This is really interesting. This is a thing that I was thinking about as well, that, you know, the guilty pleasures operates on this field of contention where somehow we are able to make our own identity almost, or construct it around our taste patterns, right? Or our profile of what we like and dislike.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, you know, I like, as everybody knows, Miami Vice 2006 and the Clint Eastwood. Surprise. Well, that came falling out of the air. Where did that come from? Well, the fact that I like that, and for instance, a Clint Eastwood, you know, it's very easy to rally a part of your identity behind that. And a part of that can be done maybe in a wink, wink, ironic way, which is, I guess, what many of the fans of maybe The Room will also do. Mm-hmm. Like they say, look at how media savvy we are, that we are actually able to appreciate the room for what it is.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hey, Johnny. What's up?
I have a problem with Lisa. She said that I hit her.
What? Well, did you?
No, it's not true. Don't even ask.
As kind of like almost a meta experience or an extra layer of
watching
film. A
man's entertainment.
Almost, yeah. Like, but then, like you say, Basha, when it becomes like really intimate and there's a part of the film that you maybe really, really deeply identify with, or there's just a part of it that is just kind of awkward or not really, you know, mm-hmm. that common, you basically have to acknowledge, well, I kind of stand out from the rest. And this is, of course, weird for people to do. I guess that this is where this comes in. And I think that is fine, except for when it's not. And when it's not, it's often because a guilty pleasure is framed in this kind of like classical archetypal way. You know, it's a lowbrow, or it's a thing from the 90s or from the 80s.
But is it still like that? I don't think so. Well, I think we're all pretty proud of our bad taste.
But this is so strange to me, though, that, you know, nowadays, for instance, like it's become, of course, you know, very not nerdy, for instance, to like comic book movies, because they're the dominant form of like mainstream blockbuster production. But what I find very interesting then is that many of those comic book films are kind of dismissive of their comic book origins. They try to be, for instance, very quippy about the source material and being kind of like almost post-ironic, treating that material, saying like, oh, this is so silly. We're in a comic book movie universe. Let's try to make this meta joke about it so we don't acknowledge that it is kind of nerdy to begin with. So it is still, even though it's mainstream, they still try to make things a guilty pleasure in a way. I'm not sure if you've reading this, but like recently the new trailer for the Spider-Man movie dropped, right? And like the trailer already makes a joke about this Octavius guy, you know, the eight-legged automated villain.
Alfred Molina.
Once played
Alfred
by
Molina again.
Yeah, exactly. And they actually make jokes about his name then in the trailer, even though like all of the names in the fucking comic book movie are silly, but it seems like the movie is resisting its own source material.
So there even is a character inside the Marvel Universe that pops up just because of that thing that you said, and it completely brings us back to guilty pleasure movies, and that's Howard the Duck, because everybody in the Marvel Universe, or before the Marvel Universe became this huge ass franchise, there was the George Lucas Howard the Duck movie that everybody completely hated.
Every duck's got his limit, and you scum have pushed me over the line.
Jimmy, do you like to see what I see? A talking duck?
Yeah, that's it. I've been doing too much toot.
Shoot! Fly away! Shoot.
No one laughs at a master of quack foo.
But now it's inside Marvel movies as this, hey, look, that's meta. It's Howard the Duck.
Yeah, and I think what's kind of dangerous about this, and that's kind of the ultimate point I want to make about it, is that many of these films are like too big to fail, right? They're like, they're so expensive. The marketing budget is so big. Everybody's supposed to go see them. I've been to Eternals as well, because I was kind of curious to see what it's like. If we're talking about like guilty pleasures, everybody should feel very guilty if they like that, I would say. That's like, there are some interesting things about it, but to be frank, the film is a piece of shit. And I'm wondering if there will be this kind of like collective sense of guilt maybe about rallying behind these films. Because often you see people who are very weaponized that you need to like these films, or that it's very bad to critique them. Like, now online as well, like Chloe Zhao, you know, she needs to make this film and it needs to be good almost, because otherwise it will be sexist or racist of us to not like it or something. There's something very strange that it's at the convenience of Disney that critics of the film are almost being silenced in favor of it.
This is a reason to like guilty pleasures, or to like the term a guilty pleasure, because maybe it's a way to differentiate between the big mainstream entertainment stuff, which you can like, it's fine, and other stuff.
So maybe it's good to like go back and look at, because for me, if I look at where do I find guilty pleasures in my life and in cinema, it's mostly things that I really enjoyed when I was younger. Mm-hmm. So that brings me into complete nostalgia mode. But then, like, looking at those films, as I said, like Twins, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Kindergarten Cop, which I love to bits. This is where we insert a quote of him screaming, "It's not a tumor."
"What's the matter?"
"I have a headache."
"It might be a tumor."
"It's not a tumor."
What's that Arnold Schwarzenegger film where he needs to buy Christmas presents?
Oh, Jingle All the Way.
Jingle All the Way. Very relevant.
This is
Black Friday.
And then we come into that special fold where something I would say is just shit, but then now Hugo will say that is his guilty pleasure movie.
That's a great film, man. That's like Black Friday.
Turboman doll.
Oh, excuse me.
Yes?
I'm trying to find the Turboman doll.
Me too, me too.
Do you have any more in the back?
What?
I see that.
What's this?
These guys are looking for a Turboman?
A gentleman doll, yes.
It's also a little bit more recent, I think, Jingle All the Way. So maybe it doesn't appeal to Tom because he was older when it came out.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom is aging.
It's
we
for
all
me.
Know
for
that.
Me, I'm
not,
aging.
Not a lot of people know that.
Not a lot of people know that. Exactly. That's true. Like for me, it's the downward slope of Schwarzenegger's career. Then you start going into not the Sixth Sense, but the Sixth.
Sixth Day.
There you go. Yes. I can't remember the title. I am so old. It's been 84 years.
It's been 84 years.
And for me, so for, I have this deep love for just a certain period of Schwarzenegger. Same goes with talking about these big action guys, because when I started making my, of course, I made another little list of guilty pleasures. There's like these of all those guys. There's one. So for Schwarzenegger, it's like the comedy period. For Jean-Claude Van Damme, I really like Hard Target. Okay, so it's directed by John Woo, which makes it better. He's called Chance Boudreau, which is just the weirdest name for a character ever. And he punches a snake, which attacks him, like mid-movie.
Jean-Claude Van Damme is the hard target.
You miss me?
From internationally acclaimed action director John Woo.
Ask Phil to be hunted!
You tell me!
Hard Target.
It's just wonderful. but it's what in Holland
Fun
we
fact,
would.
Paul Verhoeven was definitely referenced in Hard Target when he was making Benedetta.
Yes.
He was like, need some more John Woo in this movie.
Hard Target is a better film because it's a puppet there and not CGI, right? It's not Christ, superhero Christ in Benedetta showing
totally.
Up. Yeah.
This is the most important criterion for sure.
And then you have Double Impact, which I also really like.
Cool,
him playing his twin. Yeah, it's like I ended up finding some very good sort of Van Damme movies from that time. And the other one, of course, is Stallone from the same era. But then my guilty pleasure of Stallone is not Rambo 3, where I think the kill count is somewhere around 350 people that
he
kills.
That's insane.
With like a minigun that has endless bullets in one scene where you go like, maybe you should reload, actually. But no, I need to kill the Afghans.
Oh, yeah, that's what
He goes to Afghanistan. Kill pretty much everybody.
It was once dedicated to the brave Mujahideen fighters, and then it was not.
Oh my god!
In the theatrical cut, it was, and then when it got released on home release, it was dedicated to the like the survivors of the Mujahideen fighters. Like really sick.
Ancient enemy, make prayer about these people. You wish to hear?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. It says, "May God deliver us from the venom of the cobra, teeth of the tiger, and the vengeance of the Afghan." You understand what this means?
That you guys don't take any shit.
Yes, and then that gets that years later. That gets another sequel with Rambo 4
in Burma.
Yeah, and I remember that coming out, and I had to buy the Region 1 DVD theatrical cut because that had the most horrific slaughter of a village to show like, these people are so bad. Rambo needs to come in and kill them all. And to show that they are really bad. Like one soldier stabs a dog and throws him into a fire. Like, oh yeah, this is really bad. And for the European market, they took that out because everyone was like, we don't really need to see that at all. But it's so great. He kills a guy sitting in a van that has like a machine turret at the back.
Yeah.
So the guy is in the driver's seat and he just blasts him.
Absolutely splatters him. Yeah. Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
But Hugo, is it for you as well that guilty pleasure is entwined with nostalgia?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. That's kind of funny that it's almost becomes this kind of like Proustian referee of like teenage years. So maybe you just feel very like we've talked about, you know,
back to being young.
Yeah, we've talked about in a previous episode about this like sickly commercial drive of nostalgic media, entertainment. And I think that's where maybe one of the essences of like how we now consider what we consider, guilty pleasures to be, that it lies there, that, you know, we just want to maybe feel validated in our childhood preferences, or maybe we just want to accommodate our childish needs, which still are in us, but maybe we have learned to kind of put them aside or not listen to them or, you know, rationalize them or intellectualize our taste and behavior. Whereas
the thing is, we always focus on the guilty part, never on the pleasure. Part.
Yeah,
it's about pleasure.
Yeah.
And we can allow ourselves to watch things that are pleasurable. And often I think that is, going back to your childhood when you were all about the pleasure and not about the intellectual stuff.
Yeah.
But
it's like to come back to the guilty pleasure thing, like, I guess literally this is a thing that nobody maybe really talks about in this sense, but I guess the best guilty pleasures I've had as a teenage person was just literally discovering porn, right? Which was also deeply intertwined with film because you're starting.
And guilt, probably.
Yeah, and guilt, exactly. Like literally that's also like there the Christian kind of dichotomy of like pleasure and guilt really kicks in. But, you know, downloading films on the internet and then also discovering through LimeWire or Kazaa that you can download porn. I guess those things.
Sometimes like, accidentally.
I remember trying to download Blade Trinity, which is a bad film, by the way. Like, objectively.
That's not a
It was about a different Blade.
And then boom. Yeah, you know, I suddenly like entered into a brave new world of something totally different. That was, I guess, you know, if I think about that, it gave me both, I guess, guilt and pleasure. Vis-a-vis film, I think like I'm now at the point where I'm really trying to get rid of all the like notions of guilt. Just like you say, Basha, film watching should be often just pleasurable. And even if a film is not good, and I think we can all agree either as critics or programmers or just film lovers in general, that it can still be a very satisfying experience to see something either collectively or on your own that is maybe not necessarily good.
But I think it's still sometimes guilt has a function.
Yeah.
So if you say, well, I'm not feeling guilty, I'm eating meat every day. And I mean, maybe that's not the best choice. You can do it, but think about this choice that you're making. So when you say, I watch whatever I want and it gives me pleasure, I don't care. I don't believe in guilty pleasures. Maybe that's also not the best choice. Maybe sometimes it's good to be more intellectual, quote unquote, and to push yourself and to watch things that are not pleasurable or not easy to understand, but give you something lasting. But that doesn't mean that you should feel guilty when you watch something that just gives you pleasure, I think. Yeah. So you can, I think it's good to really examine what your taste is like, what every piece of taste that you have, so to say, what it is actually, and to really look at it and to think, do I feel guilty about this? Do I feel ashamed about this? Because someone is telling me that I should feel this shame, or society is telling me, or is it something that tells me that I should be careful with it?
This is interesting when you bring like different other considerations into the fold, like for instance the ethics of filmmaking or, you know, the people behind the film. I guess that, you know, we could also talk then about either, I don't know, Roman Polanski or Woody Allen, or the way that we kind of like process their films right now as well. You have these great essays by Claire Dederer about like monstrous men and the art that they create. Mm-hmm. And she's grappling with this kind of like, or she's really wrestling with the idea of, well, I'm totally obsessed with Woody Allen and his films, but I'm also obsessed with Woody Allen and his films because he is Woody Allen and he is kind of like a maybe perverted bastard. And she's basically obsessed also with the idea of being able to be that. To be a monster, to be a bad person.
She's examining it.
She's examining it. And she's, by doing that, she's, I guess, also examining this idea of like, should I feel guilty about really, really liking his stuff? Because okay, maybe
nobody is going to tell you it's forbidden to watch those movies. So you have to make up your own mind.
Exactly, exactly.
What do I think? Do I feel bad watching them? Or do I feel good and I like them? Then you should just watch them. I mean, I don't care. But this is something that
we're
going
to come to your home and kill you because you're watching Annie Hall.
Yeah. But however, I want to ask the question to all of you though, then are there films, you know, or maybe film directors or whatever, that when somebody says that they really, really like them, that you kind of want to shame them or almost kill them or go to their home with a pitchfork? Do you have that kind of like resistance to
judgment? That kind of judgment?
Yeah, maybe. Do you sometimes grapple with that as well? That you kind of sometimes judge people for their taste as well?
When Hugo says that Pain and Glory is a good movie. Yeah.
Well, I like Pain and Glory, but I'm not like a Pedro Almodovar hardliner, so I'm cool with that, you know? I'm just not gonna go all the way for him.
Oh yeah, shit. So yeah, this is my thing, that I really don't like Pedro Almodovar. Like a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a programmer of a cinema in Amsterdam, and she said to me like, you don't like Pedro Almodovar? I was like, oh, this is the moment where I get shamed. And there was this moment of silence, and she's quite a bit older than I am. And she said to me like, that's so liberating, because I also deeply hate Pedro Almodovar films. And we got to this conversation like, yeah, it's like, it gets more soapy with every movie. And I was like, oh.
That's
and
nice.
I thought,
yeah.
Why the hell do I feel liberated now that I need other people to tell me that it's okay to not like something?
Mm. Is that almost a guilty pleasure in itself, not liking something that you should like?
Ooh.
Oh, like a hate watch, like a healthy hate watch.
Guilt is also pleasurable.
Yeah, it is. Like, it's a very intoxicating, like very powerful feeling, of course. Yeah.
Because, yeah, your feelings to Pedro Almodovar is probably how I feel to Wes Anderson.
This is quite a confessional. I'll give you one though. Like, I deeply distrust people that don't like the modern Terrence Malick trilogies. Like, if people are not into To the Wonder and Knight of Cups and Sun to Sun, I deeply distrust you. I don't think this is right.
I don't think I have these kind of judgments, but I do. I'm very aware when people only name movies made by men, about men, and, you know.
I.e. Wes Anderson.
No, that's not true.
No, but Wes Anderson is better than people.
Your favorite movies can be made by men and featuring men. That's fine. But if every movie that you name is like that, then I'm starting to get a little bit suspicious, or I'm like, I don't know if we can really level.
Can we bring up Dirty Dancing now?
I don't think it's a guilty pleasure for me.
No, for me neither. But I remember, and you will remember as well, that let's say 10 years ago, that was very different.
Yeah.
I always describe this as, and listeners who are not from Holland or are expats here will not understand this maybe, but we have, I think I said this before, a channel on the TV which is called SBS6, And I always describe these films as SBS6 movies, or now RTL7 movies. Mm. They screen a lot of guilty pleasures. And I remember, like, Dirty Dancing was screened all the time, and it was, people were like, yeah, well, that's Dirty Dancing again. And that movie is like completely, it has changed. The movie itself almost has changed, but the way that we look at it now has changed a lot.
Nobody puts baby in a corner.
And that movie was made as this really serious coming of age movie for an adult audience. And then it got this, it turned out to be this really big hit because teenage girls liked it. I think this is the story behind it. And so we stopped taking it seriously. Yeah, but
we need to bring in Twilight.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But there's something that I want to read to you. Nice. And it's not about Dirty Dancing. It's actually about Sex and the City, which is also two movies, but it's more, you know,
an HBO series.
Yeah. And, Emily Nussbaum, she's the TV critic of The New Yorker. She wrote about it a couple of years ago, and I really, really liked that article, and she's really on fire. And she said, it's a defense of the series, and she says, by the show's 15-year anniversary, we fans had trained ourselves to downgrade the show to a guilty pleasure. And she's talking about why it's not a guilty pleasure and why it's actually about a female anti-hero. And then she says something that I've always remembered. She talks about an unexamined hierarchy. And she says, the assumption that anything stylized or formulaic or pleasurable or funny or feminine or explicit about sex rather than violence or made collaboratively must be inferior. So there's a lot of things going on here. And I think it's really, really interesting. And it also says something about a film like Dirty Dancing. And it also has this thing in there, or feminine, because she's talking about Sex and the City and also about Sopranos, which is really like highbrow television. But at the time they made those two shows, HBO, they were the same thing, actually. But now we, like she says, we downgraded. And that's, I think, it's sexist. It's
totally.
But it's not only about sexism. No. It's also about,
But I think it's kind of like the link between this sexism and like gender in your media consumption, but also just this general draw of like genuine eroticism in popular culture. Like, I remember, like, I worked as a librarian, and, you know, one of the most popular books, of course, in the Netherlands were the Boeketreeks. Mm. Those were, like, in Dutch, we'd call them the streekromans, like, the little novels that are taking place on the countryside.
The romance novels.
Yeah, like, a woman falls in love with, you know, maybe the gardener, or the, you know, the guy that comes to bring the pose, or whatever, just
wait,
like...
Wait. Is this leading up to you telling us that 50 Shades of Grey fits into guilty pleasure for you?
Wait, no. Oh, wait, I actually did read that book because I thought, I thought it was very, interesting how that became kind of like synonymous with this kind of like both with mainstream conceptions of like BDSM and sex things, but also just became this totally gendered attack on the book itself, that it became such a medium phenomenon that it became very popular to hate it. So I did read it. I also did watch Twilight for the same reason, because it was very easy to hate on it, just like hating back then on, I don't know, Justin Bieber or whatever, without really trying to understand what was the appeal at the first place. Mm-hmm. But this goes back like to...
And for who it was made.
For whom it was made. And this goes back to the story of being a librarian and this being one of like this series of books being the most popular books often in many libraries. And for a good reason, I guess, because they give like we said, like a sliver of pleasure. There's
escapism.
There's erotic like potential and thrills and this kind of like fantastical element to it. That's pretty neat, you know. That's pretty cool. And if it brings people to the library to read books, that's, I guess, good. But those books are often, you know, referenced as like the lowest of the lowest, the bottom of the barrel when it comes to literature. And this, all of these things get conflated even when you have a series like Sex and the City that
is probably like objectively really good, you know? Mm-hmm. That's kind of crazy.
The
That's...
second movie is not that good.
No, No, but this goes into the like capitalization of the nostalgia thing as well. Like, you know, it's kind of painful when you have something that product, even calling it a product sucks, but a thing that is genuine and nice, like a TV series, and then make a film about it. Look at the fucking Sopranos film, which is a nightmare in every possible way. That's like, the people that made that, they should feel guilty, you know, for bringing even like, for even bringing, what's the actor of Tony Soprano, Jesus, what's his name?
James Gandolfini.
To bring in Gandolfini's son into that like disastrous movie. That's awful.
Does
man.
He also act by breathing through his nose?
Because yeah, he does. Like he does the mannerism, but even more sickly, you know, to give him such a piece of shit film to work with and then wrestle with the legacy of his father.
What about something totally different? What about the "it's so bad, it's good" thing that we like about The Room?
Yeah.
The ironic viewing. How does that fit into the guilty pleasure thing?
Yeah, where does it fit in The Matrix?
I'd even up that. How does the Rocky Horror Picture Show fit in there? Because that's like, okay, so we do, these are interactive screenings that we usually do with like, they're such an interesting collective experience of something which, especially with The Room, is considered shit. So it's suffering through it collectively turns it into very human experience, I guess. And that's the same thing with what we're discussing, like the pleasure versus the guilt. Like all these things that we've discussed now are very much coming close to apparently something that's really human. That's really about, as you said, about identity, and which comes very close to who you are personally and maybe also collectively. Maybe that's the whole thing why we like it to experience.
But some of the people that come to those screenings have seen this film like a zillion times, right?
Or know it from seeing just the clip of him buying flowers and saying, "Hi, doggy.
Can I help you?
Yeah, can I have a dozen red roses, please?"
"Oh, hi, Johnny. I didn't know it was you. Here you go."
"That's me. How much is it?"
"It'll be $18.
Here you go. Keep the change. Hi, doggy.
You're my favorite customer.
Thanks a lot. Bye."
"Bye-bye."
And now wanting to see it in its complete form. And then while seeing it in the cinema, they realize it's even more than that. I remember seeing it the first time here, and I will go on record to say that, which I always do in my intros, that I've seen Tarkovsky's here, and I've seen Terminator 2 here, and I've seen, you like this, Hugo? I've seen The Tree of Life here. or Thin Red Line. But nothing comes close to seeing The Room in a fully sold out screening room, throwing spoons, quoting along, etc. I mean, you can attest to this. Yeah.
It was probably my favorite experience, but I think that's just because it was so communal. And like you said, it was a very shared experience. And
this is also what I experienced watching Drag Me to Hell, which is my favorite.
That's such a cool film.
And I was at Pathé de Munt with a full room, and everyone at the beginning of the film was watching their phones and not paying attention, and I was kind of getting irritated. But then, you know, everything is there's these jokes, and it's disgusting.
That film
and
goes so hard.
And everyone is like, there's one reaction in the
What the fuck? laughing from out.
Sam Raimi is, well, he's a very interesting on this subject because he does something really weird, right? I mean,
he makes good movies.
No, but
not a lot of people do that.
Not a lot of people know that. But he really taps into that weird stratosphere somewhere between fully be, but we didn't know we were doing it, and making something which feels like a B movie, but which is made so well that it sort of topples the system of how do you even critique that, right? I mean, from what angle are you gonna engage with that?
It's all about pleasure.
It's like a gleeful, a gleeful filmmaker who just knows, like, he just takes a lot of joy out making films look and feel nice. And this is,
and he can do it. And I mean, he has the talent to do it.
He can pull it off. And this is a thing like that I'm seeing now. And you know, like many of the films that are the most expensive at the moment just seem very lifeless in a way, just kind of almost sterile or kind of like gray slob or something. It just doesn't really trigger a lot of emotions other than you're just consuming a bit of story.
Yeah.
And this makes it impossible for it probably ever to be a guilty pleasure, because there's not that much to feel guilty about to begin with, and there's not that much pleasurable about it, I guess. And then sometimes now you go to the movies and you see a film that is a little bit genuinely crazy again, or out there, or really does something on a bigger scale with a big budget, and it's kind of catered ideally to a commercial audience. You're like, Jesus, this is so cool. This is amazing. They should make more of these films.
This is what Basia said before we started recording about the Liam Neeson movie that you saw.
The Ice Road.
Oh, I want to see that film. It's good. I totally want to see that film. I saw the trailer.
Yeah. I was like, I'm going to see this. And I went and I really liked it.
That's so cool.
But it's really bad. I mean, it is bad and they know it's bad, but there's just pleasure in that. And it's absurd. It's an absurd movie. But I still don't know how to rate it, because it's not good, but I liked it. I'm gonna forget it in a year. I'll never think about it again. So how do you rate a movie like that?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the M. Night Shyamalan film, which is, I think, one of the best films of the year. Like, genuinely, like, it's a fucking great film.
What happened to Hamal?
I don't know.
What happened to her?
Body has decomposed.
How quickly can that happen?
7 years.
But she just died.
Wait, where are the kids?
Trent!
Kara!
Come here!
Hey, have you seen my children?
Mom? I'm right here.
Dad, why are you looking at me like that?
And a lot of people think it's somehow bad because the dialogue for them seems stunted or kind of like weird or off-putting or something, which just goes to show that people just want dialogue that goes in like corn syrup, you know? They just want to like smooth stuff in a mainstream film. Whereas I'd rather have a film that kind of grates, that kind of does something weird and just does something genuinely interesting. Mm-hmm. Like that film... you can watch that film probably in 10, 20 years and think like, damn, M. Night Shyamalan was on some other shit when he made that.
Yeah.
And you're not going to think of that when you see The Eternals or something. Totally.
I will disagree with you on everything. Well, no, I will disagree with you on the twist. I hated the twist, but everything leading up to it was dragged me to hell insane.
Yeah, it was so
which
good.
Which I really
it
enjoyed.
It was so good.
But when the twist happens, it completely lost me, and then I started hating it. But I will always counterpoint this with, I remember when Signs came out, people fucking hated that film.
Yeah.
Like, everybody really hated that movie. And every time when it's on TV, I watch it.
Yeah.
And it's a fucking great film.
People break down into two groups. When they experience something lucky, group number one sees it as more than luck, more than coincidence. They see it as a sign, evidence that there is someone up there watching out for them. Group number two sees it as just pure luck, a happy turn of chance.
When you're reviewing and critiquing these films, in a professional sense, do you treat them differently, or are you taking a similar or the same approach with these guilty pleasures that you watch? Because obviously you're going to review them in some sense. No.
Well, I'm going to put all in my top 10 list of this year for our magazine, for sure. But I didn't write the review.
Would you write about it in the same way that you would write about any other film? Or are you
100%.
Conscious?
Yeah, totally. No, I'm not sure what you think of that, Basia, but I think, you know, that literally every work of art or of culture can be treated in the same way.
But you look at context
also. Yes, exactly. And our previous editor-in-chief, Dana Linse, she always said something that I think was very wise, that you can write very heavy-handed about very light things, and you can write very light about heavy-handed things, and you can do it the other way around as well. That's all fine, and that's like, that liberated me a lot. Like, you don't need to put things on the matrix of taste and level of commerce to write about it in a certain way. You can just write about everything from the same critical standpoint. But every film, of course, like you say, Basia, has its own context that you might have to grapple with, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I found it really hard to... I wouldn't like to write about Ice Road, the Ice Road, except when it was a personal essay and I could really tell something about what I enjoy about it. But I wouldn't like to review it in a quote-unquote objective way. Because then I wouldn't really know how to frame it, or it wouldn't be interesting to me.
I'm thinking about, it was very off-putting to read all the reviews of this totally different, the new Kanye West album, Donda, where it seems like everybody is just taking kind of like a critical fast track to condemn Kanye West for some of his personal views and behaviors. And then just write, the album is too mixed up in his own drama. We're going to give it 2 or 3 stars. And not engage anyhow, in any sense, almost, with any of the music, with any of the things that are the work of art.
It's
maybe
only
itself.
Context.
It's only context. Yeah. And with music, that often is easier, I guess. People conflate those two things. And I would say that in rap, context is capital. That's also how you make yourself maybe known as an artist, and you play with that as an artist. So that's fine. But then to not actually critically engage with the work of art itself is very silly to me. And was, I thought that was like very lazy. Mm. And I thought that was a great reminder for me to never do that. Like, just not like, context is key, but it's not everything, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To sort of wrap this up, I want to throw a sardine up in the air and have you cats talk about this. Because looking back on like the last couple of years as a programmer, I thought like, what's gonna, there's always like these things like there that I think like, when am I going to program this? When am I going to present these films as being more than either visible, as they would say in Life of Brian, or that people can just enjoy them with the guilt and the pleasure. Like Twilight for me especially has been just a thing that when I started working here, like there's going to be a marathon someday.
Oh, yeah, totally.
where it's going to be not people going like, oh, look, I'm now watching Twilight again. Oh no, sure. Let's watch him.
Yeah.
From the beginning, it was Nessie who wanted me there.
Nessie? You nicknamed my daughter after the Loch Ness Monster?
But a couple of years, is it 2 years ago, Cats came out.
Yeah.
And when that came out and everybody hated it, I thought like, yeah, you know what? Like, give it a couple of years. And we'll have a screening here with everybody dressed as cats. My question would be, to sort of wrap this up, is... what is the future of guilty pleasures? Because I have the feeling from this conversation that our way of looking at us has changed a bit, that but we also want to embrace the fact that it's there, the pleasure and the guilt. How are we looking at Cats and the future of guilty pleasure?
I have no idea.
Great. And that's celebrating.
Yeah, maybe.
Monigo.
Yeah, maybe we need to kind of like, you know, the audience all over the world, we need to collectivize and we need to, you know, overthrow Disney, nationalize it, banish all of the like Marvel films, just throw them in a ditch, and then spend all that sweet, sweet money on just crazy films that are way cheaper, but like, you know, let people do some weird shit. And then some of them will fill and people will not like it, but we will have something to remember in a couple of years, right? That must be the future. We need to rally around films that are allowed to be crazy again, I guess.
Yeah.
And, you know, sure. If where Cats fits into that, yeah, only time will tell. And I think that's also maybe the beauty about it, that those things can change organically, and you, like, people can kind of guide you in that and can hold your hand into this process of accepting the guilt and relishing the pleasure, maybe.
Which is what we apparently collectively do.
Yeah, totally. All the
because
time.
Because there are the movies that we've talked about, we've collectively changed the opinion that some have come up with, and we've challenged that opinion, and we've changed that. And now Dirty Dancing is a great film.
Yeah. It is.
It's a very hopeful thing, maybe.
I think if we just kind of rally against normalcy, or this idea that there is this normal center, and just try to push each other to go further in the things that we like that are kind of crazy, that's kind of cool. You want friends that like crazy things, right? You don't only want friends that like the top 10 on IMDb. Although those films are actually kind of fine as well. Yeah, but you want to be challenged. Yes. Yeah. So that's kind of like the aim, maybe. And that takes some resisting nowadays, maybe, because there's a lot of films that are kind of blech.
And that's the thing about The Room. It is pleasurable, but it's also challenging in a way. So I think we've come full circle.
Yeah.
Well, and on that note, tomorrow we're sold out, and on Saturday we're sold out as well. So no room for you.
No room for The Room. Well, that just means that is a film that will have to be screened more often, and people will just have to maybe see that and experience it firsthand, and also experience the challenge and see where that brings them, you know? Who knows?
Yeah. Open up.
Could you ever see yourself doing a week of these kind of films?
A week?
Marathon.
Well, why not?
Maybe.
I mean, this is the moment where Hugo now will interject me and say, like, when is the Fast and the Furious franchise playing?
Family.
My brother never told you never threaten a man's family. It's a pretty stupid thing to do.
Like, you never turn your back on family.
There's always room for family. Salute me, familia. I don't have friends. I got family. What's real? His family, your family. Hold on to that, Brian. You don't turn your back on family.
Let me ask you something, Dom. What's the best thing in your life?
Family.
No, it's not.
You killed Han. Almost killed my family.
But it would be cool if there would be like a guilty pleasure festival, and like every, like, different people can kind of like share their guilty pleasure and be proud of it, like,
confessional
guilty pleasure
confestival
thing. Yeah.
Yes.
Confestival.
That's it.
Like, everybody can have one, and we can all say to each other, like, there's nothing to be guilty about. Yeah, that's
okay.
A great
it's okay. Yeah.
Shit, that's
and we
good
end
idea.
With a like this
yeah,
hug.
A big hug.
We're just, human.
And then we topple Disney. Then we overthrow Disney.
What is your thing with Disney?
Man, they're kind of going against this whole thing, man. They're just trying to make mediocre slob, man.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with Walt Disney.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Mickey Mouse.
Well, if you've got any suggestions for our Confestival.
Yeah, I want to hear other people's guilty pleasures, man. Yeah, shout.
Send them in to Celebrating Cinema at Lab 111.
Maybe we can discuss like a guilty pleasure every episode from now, and then just say that they shouldn't feel guilty about it.
Yeah.
We can make this.
Confessional corner.
Yeah, the confessional corner. Yeah.
Well, write in, please. Let us know. Thank you, Basha, as always, for joining us. Hopefully we'll have another great episode for you to join us.
Okay.
With Christmas on the horizon, we're going to attempt to do an alternative Christmas special. So that's what's up next. Otherwise, thank you for listening.
I really enjoy that. Not a lot of people know that.